Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Rogue Angel by Alex Archer. Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Colleen Delaney, Richard Rowan, James Konacek, Kimberly Gilbert, Matthew Bassett, Stephen Carpenter, Allison Thomas, Bradley Smith, Christopher Sheeran, Danny Gavigan, David Coyne, Elizabeth Jernigan, Eric Messner, Evan Casey, Jonathan Watkins, Ken Jackson, Michael John Casey, Nanette Savard, Mort Shelby, Rose Elizabeth Supan, Nick DePinto, Nora Ashradi, Thomas Keegan, Tim Getman, and Yasmin Twazan. Rogue Angel 39, City of Swords.
His arrow struck deep in the deer's chest, but missed the heart. The animal struggled to get up, tangling itself in the tall grass. Dragging one leg, the man limped toward it. Though always a heavily built man, sturdy, he preferred to think of himself, he used to get around effortlessly. But age had taken its toll, coupled with the fevers that had plagued him these past few months. His doctors demanded he avoid roast meat. Who were they to tell a king what to do? Boiled venison was not so tasty, and he intended to savor a properly prepared roast tonight. Charlemagne drew his sword, the blade catching the late afternoon sun and taking on a molten cast. He couldn't stand to see the animal suffer. One slash across the throat finished the deer.
This sword, my friend, has already killed a great many men.
Two of his men dragged the deer back to Charlemagne's home. Charlemagne cleaned his blade first, then bathed and dressed for dinner, wearing a linen shirt against his skin and matching breeches. Over this, he wore a dark tunic trimmed with a pale silk fringe, the one bit of finery he allowed himself. He preferred to dress like a commoner, leaving aside all but one jeweled ring he wore. Lastly, he put on ivory hose and comfortable shoes. Charlemagne left the room, but returned to check himself in the mirror. There were guests to consider tonight, and he wanted to appear well-groomed. Despite his years, he remained good-looking. His hair was white, but there was an abundance of it. He arranged the curls with his fingers, squared his shoulders, pronounced himself acceptable, and went downstairs. Among the dinner guests he was about to greet was his son Louis, whom he had recently crowned. It would be good to see him again and to speak of politics and alliances. No doubt someone would ask to hear tales from one of his great battles. Charlemagne had been engaged in one clash after another throughout nearly all his reign, usually at the front of his bodyguard squadrons, but sometimes alone when there was no one to bear witness. Always with his sword, Joyeuse, in hand. Charlemagne patted the scabbard. 3 decades of fighting, more than a dozen wars, and now this sword was relegated to putting a deer out of its misery. Perhaps he would regale those gathered with that final push he'd orchestrated to conquer Saxonia and to convert the barbarians to Christianity. It was a good story, and he didn't mind retelling it. Then he would excuse himself and retire early, as he planned to venture out again at first light. A few more days of hunting, then he would travel to Aachen, given the onset of November. He'd come to enjoy hunting animals far more than he'd ever enjoyed hunting men. Charlemagne's plans to return to the hunt in the spring would never materialize, as he would fall ill with pleurisy. He took to his bed a final time.
Joyeuse, my sword.
A servant placed the sword at his side. Charlemagne wrapped his thick fingers around the pommel. This sword, his one constant companion, gave him some measure of peace.
Joyeuse, my very dear friend.
Charlemagne died. The sword was Anya Creed's one constant companion. It was a yard of double-bladed steel, honed impossibly sharp. Though a priceless relic, it was not a showpiece suited to a museum. It was a dealer of death, her servant and master, good fortune and wretched curse. Once belonging to Joan of Arc, shattered and mysteriously reformed, it had come to Anya, along with a destiny to wield it wisely. Anya was in France for a two-part segment for Chasing History's Monsters. Her TV show's producers were really scraping the bottom of the barrel for legends to sensationalize. The past 4 days had taken Anya and her cameraman under the city to the famous Paris catacombs. It was familiar ground for Anya, who'd explored the chambers where long-buried skeletons were stashed to make room for more bodies in the city's overcrowded cemeteries. The tunnels under Paris had a fascinating and rich history, most of which had already been done to death on TV. Anya's assignment had been to find something fresh. A skilled archaeologist, Anya certainly had an affinity for ruins. Even so, it was tough to get excited about this assignment. She hadn't wanted to come to France. It was a place of nightmares for her. Joan of Arc had been lashed to a pillar in the Vieux Marché in Rouen and burned at the stake in 1431. After her horrible death, her body was burned a second time, and then a third, the ashes scattered into the Seine. Anya was somehow connected to the holy martyr, and her sleep on occasion was cut through with fiery images. But while France held nightmares for her, it was also a paycheck, at least this week. Anya had finished her work shortly before 5 today, showered, dressed in the only couture outfit she'd brought to the city, and took her cameraman to Pierre Gagnard's in the 8th District for fish terrine. Anya had come alone to this train platform, looking for a fight. She needed the exercise to burn off some of the evening's rich meal, but something else compelled her, an unidentifiable itch to be scratched. This wasn't the first inexplicable tugging she'd felt to do something, and Anya had just learned not to question it. Familiar with Paris, she knew to avoid Les Halles, Le Châtelet, and Gare du Nord this late at night, when the crowds had disappeared. So that's precisely where she'd ventured. Les Halles and Le Châtelet yielded no opponents, but Gare du Nord and its shadowy side streets brought out this fellow and his now absent friends. Tourists traveling alone around the old train station were warned to keep a low profile and to avoid wearing jewelry that might entice thieves, but Anya had done the opposite. In the sequin-trimmed cocktail dress she'd worn earlier to dinner, emerald necklace dangling in the low V of the fabric, Anya had trolled back and forth like a fisherman after bass. And sure enough, she managed to attract the attention of some young thugs, one of them more than willing to give her the fight she'd hoped for. This ruffian thought he'd have the upper hand, armed with his switchblade, but was unpleasantly surprised when Anya called forth her sword from the otherwhere. The lights from the train station were diffused by the thin fog and distorted the blade so it looked like a ribbon of darkened silver. The switchblade he wielded was no match for her sword. He should have fled as his two companions had moments ago, but he stood there, puffing himself up with the bravado of youth. Anya swung the sword above her head in a flashy move meant to rattle her less skilled opponent.
Fight fair.
All right, I'll fight you on equal terms.
With a thought, she dismissed the sword, relegating it to the otherwear where it hung, waiting for her to summon it again. Her opponent glanced quickly at the ground and into the shadows. Not spotting the sword, he returned his full attention to her.
You witch!
Anya crouched to meet his charge. He didn't disappoint her, darting in and slashing forward. Anya sidestepped and brought up her foot, catching his ankle. He stumbled, but managed to keep his balance. He whirled toward her, eyes narrowed.
Bitch!
Such language.
Fuck off! I'll throw you to the dogs.
No, I'll throw you to the police.
From his accent, Anya guessed that the fellow was probably from one of the Roma camps. France had declared war against the illegal encampments that had sprung up around Paris, evacuating many of the immigrants living there. But the Romani were entrenched. Paris news agencies had been reporting on the itinerant gangs, preying on travelers arriving from London on the high-speed trains. Now, Anya was preying on one of those gang members. He shuffled to his right, putting his back to an old stone wall and tossing the knife into his other hand, trying to rattle her. Anya waited for him to make the next move. He came at her, this time stabbing at her side.
What?
Then he wheeled and darted at her again. His sudden move managed to slice her dress. Anya cursed herself for underestimating the youth. A street brawler, yes, but somewhere along the line, he'd had training. She appraised him more carefully. The sleeves of his shirt were tight around his biceps, suggesting muscles. His calves were thick, too. Certainly not the common ruffian she'd originally considered him to be. As he came forward and jabbed at her, then shuffled back, she realized his moves were those of a boxer.
You might make a better opponent than I thought.
Cocksucking beach.
Sticks and stones.
He pointed the knife tip at her throat and made a gesture with his free hand.
Yes, I gather that you want my necklace. I'm rather fond of it. A gift from an old friend.
The thug continued to come at her, jumping in and back, swinging his knife and alternately punching with his free hand. He didn't connect with anything, but he also didn't give up. Anya moved out of his way each time, kept him close, not wanting to discourage him. She was in heels, and the spikes caught in the cracks of the brick, threatening to topple her. It would have been easier to slip out of them, but she didn't want easy tonight.
Die, you bitch!
No, I'm not gonna die tonight. But neither will you. We're just playing, aren't we? Like children looking to run off a little steam? Having fun, you little prick.
He sped up his rushes, sweeping the blade in a wider and wider arc, his anger making his moves more erratic and easier to dodge.
Go to hell!
Not tonight.
He jockeyed for position, which allowed her to step onto the sidewalk, easier on her heels.
Damn you!
Then Anya took the initiative. She stepped in and thumped him on the chest with her open hand. Finally, he was showing signs of fatigue, but he still wasn't giving up, his predatory gaze lingering on the emerald necklace.
The man who gave me this said it was 400 years old, give or take a decade. Worth as much for its historic value as for the gems. You'd probably fence it for a few cases of Alizé Bleu.
The combat had managed to wash away her fatigue. Maybe it was time to call it a night. Her opponent took a few steps back and cocked his head, listening. Anya listened, too. The approaching footsteps announced the return of the Hood's companions. They'd brought help. Altogether, there were 7 of them.
Now you're fucked, you dirty whore.
Anya felt for the sword in her mind, but waited. She delivered a roundhouse kick to her dancing partner, her pointed heel jabbing his stomach. He doubled over and dropped the switchblade. Anya kicked him once more, angling higher and pounding her foot against his chest. He slumped to his knees. She administered a quick neck chop, which rendered him unconscious. Then she devoted her attention to the remaining 6.
You will die for that!
The tallest one brandished a gun and pulled the trigger. The bullet came close, passing where Anya's head had been a heartbeat before. On reflex, she ducked just as he'd reached into his jacket pocket. Anya rolled forward, deliberately losing her shoes and coming up in a crouch. Don't bring a knife to a gunfight, or in her case, a sword. Still, in her mind, she touched the blade, seeking its reassuring presence. Anya took one glance at the gang. Then she slipped to where the shadows were thickest along the wall. The patchy fog and darkness made the men seem even more menacing. The tallest gang member was well over 6 feet, thin, but with broad shoulders, like a dagger that had been jammed tip first into the street. He was in the front, 2 each to his right and left, back a few feet. So the guy she'd fought moments ago wasn't the gang leader. The others were all of similar build to the tall one with the gun, and all had the oddly cropped and spiky hair their unconscious fellow sported. A 6th held back. He also had a gun with a silencer. That they had guns with silencers marked them as a notch above a common gang. The guns were probably stolen. The newcomers scanned the area, taking in the guy she'd knocked out.
Well, I didn't quite bargain for this now, did I? Me and my impulses.
One of the men moved his arms to his sides, showing that he had a length of chain for a weapon. The other 3 produced switchblades, 1 in each hand.
Girl, come out or we can get a better look at you. We won't hurt you.
Much.
Anya felt their eyes on her. They knew exactly where she was. She also sensed other eyes on her. Another gang member?
Come out, girl! Girl, come out.
Come out, wherever you are.
She did just that. In a blur of taupe taffeta, chiffon, and sequins, Anya surprised both gunmen who couldn't draw a bead. She slammed into the lead one, striking his throat with her elbow. Anya grabbed his gun with her other hand, throwing it behind her. She pulled her 2nd elbow jab, not wanting to kill him. Anya had to crouch to duck the chain now swinging her way. 5 left standing. Make that 4. Almost too easy.
Foul!
The other man with the gun glared at her. He was older than the others, with a short beard and a dead eye.
Whoa!
He shot, missed her.
Die!
This time, the bullet grazed her arm. Anya felt as if an open flame had been put to her skin. She slipped by the three men surrounding her and raced toward the one-eyed gunman. She darted left when he brought the gun up again. The sword was in her hand. The combination of his surprise and the sword's impact on his hand sent the gun tumbling from his grip. Anya spun. She brought the flat of the blade around again, striking him in the arm. She cuffed the one-eyed man on the neck and rendered him unconscious. Anya turned to face the remaining three. And then the one with the chain lashed her chest. She doubled over, still managing to point the sword at him. He doggedly whipped the chain at her again and caught the blade. Anya sliced down with the sword, using just enough force to wound him, but not cut off his arm.
Enough!
He grasped his bleeding arm and held it close. Behind him, the others took off running. Anya realized they'd been the same two who had run away at the beginning and come back with reinforcements. Would they return with still more?
Enough! I give up!
Anya willed the sword away, and despite her pain, shoved the man toward the wall. In the shadows there, Anya found her purse, which she had dropped when she'd picked the fight with the first youth. She grabbed it, took her cell phone out, and called the police.
I'm at Gare du Nord. I've just been accosted by a Roma gang. No, I'm all right. Some vigilantes came to my aid. Yes, thank you.
Well, it was half true. Prodding the man to stay ahead of her, Anya nudged him toward her shoes, which she gingerly put on. Then she directed him to sit near one of his fallen fellows.
Wait for the police.
When she heard the sirens, she returned to the shadows, following the wall back to the old train station, and toward where she had earlier sensed someone else watching her.
Rue.
You're hurt.
I'll heal.
Rather quickly, no doubt. And what was all of that for, Anya Creed?
As the wail of the sirens grew louder, Anya glanced toward the men, making sure none of them had bolted. She touched her arm, feeling the sting from the bullet and the warmth of her blood. There was a first aid kit in her suitcase at the hotel. She always traveled with one. Anya and Rue kept close to the front of the massive Gare du Nord. The original train station had been demolished a century and a half ago, deemed too small. This huge affair, built in its place, was one of Anya's favorite places in Paris. Its facade was created around a triumphal arch, the main cast-iron support beams supplied by an ironworks in Glasgow. In daylight, you could see eight statues along the building's cornice, each representing international destinations: London, Brussels, Vienna, Warsaw, Frankfurt, Amsterdam, Berlin, Cologne. Well past midnight now, there were a few souls about, some gaping down the street in the direction of the downed gang. From the cover of their vantage point, Anya and Rue watched as a police car arrived, its flashing ice-blue lights cutting through the thinning fog. A van pulled in behind it, and policemen spilled out. Like swarming ants, they took control of the Romanys, lifting the unconscious forms and handcuffing the older one. Anya couldn't hear what they were saying, but the older man pointed with his head toward the shadows and the train station. Anya started to move again, as fast as she dared, without drawing attention. She pulled Rue along with her. They reached the far end of the station and turned the corner.
Didn't want to stick around and explain yourself to the police?
I'll be in France for the better part of another week.
More than enough time for you to pick another fight with the Romani gangs. Getting more underground footage for your television program?
I'm done in the catacombs. I leave tomorrow. Later today, actually, for Avignon.
A vacation? It would certainly be long overdue. Or are you working on another episode of Chasing Historical Monsters?
Chasing History's Monsters. And yes, that's why I'm going to Avignon. My producer is being cost-conscious. Doug figures if he's sending a crew to France, he may as well get several segments out of it. So we did the tunnels under Paris.
And what lies under Avignon? Just making conversation, Anya.
The Cynocephalus and St. Christopher.
The what?
Old man, you don't know about St. Christopher and the legend of the Cynocephalus?
Sorry, no.
Cynocephali are said to be dog-headed men. They come up in a lot of anecdotal accounts of history. Centuries back, they supposedly sent a delegation to the Pope in Avignon. Some of the medieval legends paint St. Christopher as one of the Cynocephali.
Fascinating.
In any event, my producer found a posting on the internet that some dog-headed men were spotted by tourists in Avignon a few weeks ago.
Probably some costumed youths.
Or real dogs, transformed by Photoshop.
Beautiful place, Avignon. The city of the popes in the 13 and 1400s.
The Catholic schism. I've visited Avignon before, and I don't get tired of it. One of the few cities in France to have maintained its ramparts and Rocher des Dons.
And the bridge of Avignon, on the left bank of the Rhône. And the place where Anya Creed will chase her next historical monster.
Rue pivoted to stand in front of her, his pale blue eyes peering into her green ones.
Be careful, Anya, that an historical monster does not come chasing you.
Sarah drove a 2005 Peugeot 607, four-door gunmetal gray. It didn't look like anything special. Because it was a manual, she was at the wheel rather than her passenger, who was in charge of this foray. The Peugeot handled a little stiffly. Sarah preferred smaller, splashier sports cars, but they'd needed something as unnoticeable as possible. Arshar sat next to her in the passenger seat. He wasn't that old. In his late 30s, maybe 40, tops, Sarah guessed, which put him at about twice her age. Her window was down, and she had the vent going full blast to cut the reek of smoke left from previous drivers. Arshar didn't seem bothered by the smell.
Do you smoke?
Slow down. Wouldn't want to get in an accident. Or a speeding ticket.
Of course, Arshar. But next time we rent an automatic and you drive. I'm tired of your constant directions.
Arshar had been at her since they'd left Paris, suggesting when she should change lanes and which turnoffs to take. He'd picked the route. He was more familiar with this part of France, but that didn't mean his constant corrections were any less annoying. It was enough that Sarah sometimes heard voices in her head. Voices that had told her to take this trip with Arshar. She didn't need him talking, too. It was nearing noon when they reached Rocamadour. She'd wanted to stop well outside of the town and come in after dark, but Arshar had insisted they arrive early.
Being ahead of schedule is always best. It allows for the unexpected, and it lets us look around.
Sarah knew better than to argue. Arshar was one of Lawton's senior knights, and at the moment she was just a lackey. With luck, though, and a good performance today, that would change.
Park in the lower city. You...
I've been here before.
It was a lie, but what did that little one matter? Besides, the place had a population of less than 1,000, so how hard could it be to find her way around?
Give me a minute and I'll find a good spot.
When were you here?
She ducked the question by pulling into a small lot.
Quaint.
Or worse than quaint. Sarah loved Paris. So busy, lively, colorful, loud. This was anything but. Perched on a rocky plateau that overlooked the Alzou Valley, the town was known for its incredible views and historical religious sites.
So why way down here?
For a handful of hours, we are sightseers, Sarah. Enjoying the weather, taking a tour, stopping for lunch.
She let him steer her to the second floor of the Envie de Terroir. They took a table by the window. It was a little large for just the two of them, but it was away from the other diners, and they could talk without being overheard. Arshar ordered the lunch special for them, ventrèche, tomato tartine, and glasses of wine.
I'm surprised you're drinking. More that you're letting me drink.
We'll walk it off long before tonight.
Later, he ordered a second glass, and Sarah was quick to ask for a raspberry and almond tart from the cart the waiter was pushing.
Since you're buying. Good food. Place is a little quiet, but it'll do.
Everything was a little quiet here. Arshar finished his wine and paid the bill.
More than a million tourists come here every year, Sarah. Some for the wine, most for the buildings. Pilgrims, too.
Were you one of them? A pilgrim?
That was many years ago.
How many?
I was young. Let's ride the elevator from the lower town, Basseville. We'll take the stairs tonight.
The architecture was amazing, and Sarah wished she really had been here before, so she could have taken time to properly explore. She had been enrolled as a European history major when she'd dropped out of the University of Provence-Aix-Marseille a month ago in her second semester. Her current career path was more interesting. Arshar remained silent while a few more tourists boarded the elevator and it started its ascent. A young woman in a low-cut shirt was pressed against him, but he showed no reaction.
When you were here before, Sarah, did you come for the Black Madonna, the centerpiece of Chapelle Notre Dame?
Sure. A casual tourist, you know.
Sarah had to stop lying in an effort to impress this man. She watched as the cluster of churches and chapels came into view, and then quickly stepped out of the elevator when it reached the top. Sarah and Arshar pretended to browse the souvenir shops before taking a walking tour of the Basilique Saint-Sauveur. The hours ticked by, and she found herself actually enjoying the day, until the sun started to set. They took the last elevator ride back down to the lower town, and anxiety set in. Arshar noticed.
Are you certain you're up for this, Sarah?
It's what we came here for, right? And you can't do it without me. Yes, I'm up for this. I've been looking forward to this since Dr. Lawton lectured about it.
Dinner first.
But...
We need the night, and the good meal will help pass the time. Aren't you hungry?
Dinner was at the Beau Site Géant de Vallon, and she ordered for herself this time an omelette with truffles, one of the most expensive items on the menu, and a salad. Arshar opted for the duck steak carpaccio with sliced cantaloupe. They both had a liberal amount of coffee.
So you were a pilgrim?
I studied with the Benedictine monks here, and I had the good fortune to scrub the floor of the Chapelle Miraculeuse, where the tomb of Saint Amadour is located.
And he is...
No one to concern us tonight.
Sarah shrugged and looked out the window, watching four women carrying lit candles.
So the Chapelle Miraculeuse...
Is not where we are going.
I know! I took courses from Dr. Lawton first semester, and...
That makes you an expert, eh?
Is it dark enough yet?
Yes, but not late enough. Patience, Sarah. Patience is...
A virtue.
They got candles out of the trunk of the rental car and joined a small procession, climbing up the Grand Escalier, a weathered stone stairway to the chapels they'd toured earlier in the day. Sarah counted the steps. 216. No wonder they'd taken the elevator the first time. The climb wasn't taxing to her, though. In fact, Sarah wished the people in front of them would walk faster. They paused at each of the 14 stations of the cross until they reached the Cross of Jerusalem at the top. Contrary to Sarah's expectations, Arshar showed no sign of fatigue. The same could not be said for some of the tourists who had ascended with them.
When you came here on a pilgrimage...
I took the stairs on my knees, as is customary when seeking penance.
Tough on your pants, I'll bet.
This is a holy place. Your footsteps will fall on stones touched by Zacchaeus of Jericho, Saint Dominique, Saint Bernard, perhaps even Charlemagne, when he prepared to fight the Spanish Moors. Miracles happen here. Healings, conversions. Do not mock this place.
Sorry.
The buildings looked different in the dark. The Romanesque Gothic style made eerie in the flickering light from the candles and the pale glow that spilled from a few windows. Sarah and Arshar mingled with the tourists, many of them praying softly, their voices lost in the strains of a chant coming from the nearest chapel. Arshar prayed too, though Sarah couldn't hear him. She just noticed his lips moving and his thumbs rubbing against the base of his candle. Sarah hadn't been to church since she'd lived with her parents in Delaware, but she wasn't irreligious. Deciding that it would be appropriate to copy the others, and that God might actually pay attention here, Sarah bowed her head and prayed that she wouldn't screw up. An hour later, she and Arshar tossed their candles and hid in an alcove of the Basilique Saint-Sauveur, where they waited until the last tourist left. Sarah guessed that it was early morning, maybe 2 or 3, judging by how tired she was. The buzz from the coffee had worn off a while ago.
I'll see to security. In a few minutes, I'll meet you inside the chapelle.
Sarah counted to 100, then glided next door to the Chapelle Notre-Dame. Arshar said there was security, and she had no doubt it was high-tech, though decidedly out of place in the old buildings. The Black Madonna, which she'd read about in a tourist pamphlet in one of the souvenir shops, was the focal point of this building. Hopefully, the bulk of the security efforts were tied to the Madonna. Sarah waited for a second count of 100. Still no Arshar.
Great.
So far, she'd done nothing illegal. She could hightail it out of here and go back to her studio apartment on Avenue Georges V.
This is your destiny.
Instead, Sarah went through the arch. No alarms went off. Sarah pulled a tiny flashlight out of her pocket, cupped her hand over the top, and aimed it around until she found what she was looking for. Then she switched the light off, tiptoed to the wall, and took off her shoes. She didn't want her rubber soles marring the wall or squeaking. She tugged a pair of tight-fitting gloves out of her pocket and wiggled into them, though she wasn't especially worried about leaving fingerprints. She'd never been in trouble before. Still, it was a precaution.
Where is Urshar?
She felt along the wall and found the natural cracks in the stonework. Wedging her fingers in, she slowly pulled herself up. The muscles in her arms bunched and her chest tightened.
Nerves.
Sarah thought of the chant she'd listened to earlier. The sound had been soothing.
Relax.
She pulled herself higher, relying only on her handholds, her feet spread in a ballet dancer's second position against the stone.
Relax.
Sarah felt a ledge and gripped it. The pain in her fingers helped her focus. A little higher, and there was a second ledge, which she pulled herself onto, resting her knees. Finding a good handhold, she leaned backward, one arm outstretched, fingers searching, searching, finding a beam. Sarah wrapped her arms and legs around it and inched out upside down. If she fell, she might break a leg or something. It probably wouldn't kill her, but it would get her in a world of trouble, and Dr. Lawton would be furious.
What the hell is Urshar?
Farther, a little farther. It was so dark in here. Sarah was on the underside of an overhang, and the shadows were making this more than a little difficult. The flashlight wasn't an option. It had been risky using it the first time. A dozen or so more inches, and there. Her eyes managed to distinguish the blackness just enough. Sarah clamped her legs tight on the beam, stretched out, and wrapped her fingers around the pommel. The sword was suspended from the ceiling just beyond the archway. She cursed herself for not looking closer when they'd taken the tour this afternoon. Maybe she could have asked one of the monks what was holding it. She tugged without success.
Damn it!
Sarah inched out farther, pulled harder, ground her teeth together, and gave it one more yank. The voices in her head encouraged her.
You can do this! You can do this now!
The sword still wasn't free, just loose from one of the cords. No matter how many cords remained, Sarah had come too far to stop. She pulled again as hard as she could. Sarah managed to catch herself from falling with her legs, but she was dangling, her free arm flailing, the sword grasped in the other. The iron weapon was heavy. She squeezed the pommel tight so she wouldn't drop it.
Come on. Come on.
Sarah drew herself up, wrapping her free arm around the beam and wedging the sword against her chest. Getting back to the wall took what felt like an eternity. Another long stretch of time passed before she reached the floor. Sarah laid the sword down very slowly so as to be quiet. She put her shoes back on and picked the blade up again. She heard no footfalls. She heard nothing except her heart pounding thunderously. Keeping her back against the stone wall, she crept along the alcove, stopping every few steps to listen again.
Now to get out of here.
Although it felt as though hours had gone by, it had been merely minutes. Light from the scattering of street lamps in the Basse-Ville, the part of town below the cliff, seeped up like the glow from a halo.
A monk!
No, not one of the monks. It was Urshar. He came around the side of the chapelle and headed toward her.
Where the hell were you?
He set his finger to his lips and took the heavy sword from her. Then he nodded toward the stairs.
Hadi.
Where were you?
There was a little more security than I anticipated.
Urshar pulled her into a niche between the buildings and then grabbed her hand, tugging off her glove and touching her fingers to the tip of the stolen sword. It was broken, jagged.
So it is Ryu. See? The genuine one. You did great. Now get the rest of it. I'll meet you at the car. And Sarah, speed would be good.
He reached into a pocket and handed her a small GPS device. It blinked softly with her coordinates. From another pocket, he produced a chisel. Getting the rest of it proved much easier said than done. They motored out of the village at dawn, Sarah's bleeding fingers gripping the steering wheel of the Peugeot, her clothes torn, her knees badly scraped, and every inch of her throbbing. Anya couldn't sleep. She sat up and swung her legs over the edge of the bed to pull on a pair of sweatpants. Her stomach churned, and a bitter taste settled in her mouth. She'd had another nightmare. Images of fire swirling all around, bright red and orange, painful in their intensity. Like before, there was a face in the flames. Sometimes the face was her own, and she woke up from those nightmares sweating. She was drenched in sweat now. Anya slipped on the athletic shoes that had set her back half a paycheck. Then she got up, stuck her hotel key card in her pocket, and reached for a fresh t-shirt. She wanted to be home, curled up on her bed, shutting out the god-awful blare of the Brooklyn traffic. She could sleep through that ruckus, somehow even found it comforting. But in France, she often had nightmares. Not always, but enough that she wondered why she bothered to come back. Why hadn't she told Doug to get someone else for these segments? She looked at the clock on the nightstand. 1:45. A quick run. That ought to get her through this. Certainly safer than picking a fight with a gang of punks outside one of the city's old train stations. She made sure the door clicked shut behind her, and then padded past the bank of elevators to the security door at the end of the hall. She eased that shut behind her, too. Anya jogged down from the 8th to the 7th floor landing, turned, and headed toward the 6th. The air was fusty and stale. The stairwell was dimly lit, with energy-saving spiral fluorescent lights. It was intended to be used for emergencies, not guests suffering from insomnia. The walls were painted a hospital green, reminding her of guacamole. They and the security doors were thick enough that she shouldn't disturb anyone's beauty sleep. Anya hit the 4th floor landing and picked up speed. She loved to run. Anya felt the beginning of an exercise burn in her chest as she reached the 1st floor and wheeled around to start the jog back up. The smell of cleanser lingered like a thick fog. She thumbed the button on her iPod and inserted the earbuds without missing a step or losing her cadence. Anya again neared the 8th floor landing. 12 more floors to go to the top of the hotel before returning to her room for a welcome shower and a few hours of good sleep. That was the plan. She felt wired, as if she'd just thrown back 6 cups of coffee. Maybe she'd do 2 circuits instead. That'd be enough. Yeah, better than a sleeping pill. She reached the 10th floor. Anya heard 2 more insomniacs entering the stairwell above her. She pressed herself against the wall of the 11th floor landing as they descended toward her. 2 young women she'd seen in the restaurant during dinner. They sported bright green Marathon du Médoc t-shirts. They smiled as they bounced by. She recalled reading about a marathon in town in another day or two. These were no doubt entrants. At the 16th floor landing, she ran faster. The burn in her chest had spread to her neck. Her face was flushed from the mild exertion, and her heart rate was up. The stale air reached deeper into her lungs, and she felt a sensation in her legs that wasn't quite an ache, but was telling Anya that her muscles were stretching from the climb. It was a good feeling. As she neared the uppermost landing, Anya brushed the door to the roof with her fingers, leaving 4 thin streaks of sweat, then spun on her heel and started back down. She passed the Marathon du Médoc runners again on the 6th floor landing. They were coming up this time and pressed themselves against the wall to let her continue. Common runner courtesy. At the bottom, the reek of bleach again assailed Anya. She touched down on the landing, brushed her fingers against the 1st floor door, and then started up. She spotted 2 more insomniacs when she turned on the 7th floor and started up the next flight. They stood shoulder to shoulder on the 8th floor landing, blocking her path. Dressed in dark pants and jackets, they reminded her of the Blues Brothers. One was tall, the other shorter and stocky with a pockmarked face. The stocky one wore sunglasses despite the stairwell's dim lighting, which set Anya's nerves tingling. She jogged in place on the stairs, halfway between landings, and plucked out her earbuds. Anya waited for the men to move or to say something. Neither did.
Excuse me.
She reached the step just below them. They backed up, but not enough for her to reach the landing door. She didn't like the looks of them, and hackles rose on her neck.
This is my floor.
She thought about reaching for the sword, but they hadn't threatened her. Maybe they were with the Marathon du Médoc runners. The stocky one tilted his head to the side, nodded in comprehension and smiled, took a step back to accommodate her. Without warning, the tall one's fist shot out like a piston, striking her on the shoulder, catching her off guard. Anya fell, arms flailing. Her leg struck the stairs and her back slammed down as she bumped and slid to the lower landing. Her head bounced hard against the tile and her vision swam. Her right ankle hurt like hell, definitely sprained, maybe broken, and she felt as if a truck had fallen on her. She tried to get up, but her head was spinning, making the stairwell's hospital green paint a sickening swirl of color. The tall man clomped down the steps. He yanked her by the waistband. The sword. She felt for it with her mind, but everything was out of sync, and she raced toward merciful unconsciousness. As he came down the stairs, the stocky one took off his sunglasses, revealing little black pig eyes.
Where is it? In your room?
He heaved Anya around the corner to the next set of stairs. She was pitched down flight after flight. The sword hung beyond her reach. In an otherworldly space, her mind was too muddled to access. Bending over her on the fifth floor landing, the stocky one took Anya's iPod and stuck it into his pocket, pausing just long enough to turn the device off. He found the hotel key card in her pants.
Let's check her room.
The tall man nodded in agreement as the blackness reached up to claim Anya. Arshar placed the sword on the altar. First the large section, and then the smaller one that Sarah had worked herself bloody to prize out of the cliff. In the gap between the two pieces, the black velvet looked like oil in the dim overhead light. A yard long, the section near the haft was jagged and reminded him of a bolt of lightning. He bent over the blade, seeing his gray eyes reflected back at him, with faint lines visible at the corners. The years were starting to show.
Durandal.
Durandal. Durlindana. Durandarte. God touched. Dr. Lawton will be pleased.
Indeed, most pleased. The sword of Charlemagne's paladin, Roland.
Destined to be yours now. You are the doctor's lead knight.
I read about Roland in Dr. Lawton's textbook. Some called him Orlando and the sword.
Annoyed glances from all three men made Sarah stop. Arshar closed his eyes and prayed silently to himself over the weapon. The other two tugged Sarah back to give him time alone with the sword.
You endure.
Arshar had finished his prayer. The name Durandal was believed to have come from the French word durer, meaning to endure. Despite Roland's attempt to destroy it to keep it out of enemy hands, the blade had survived. Damaged, but it still endured. In Italy, it was called Durlindana, and in Spain, Durandarte. Just as Charlemagne had presented it to Roland, Dr. Lawton said it was to be Arshar's now. Once said to belong to the fabled Hector of Troy, it was supposed to have been forged by a mysterious Berkshire master blacksmith named Wayland. Its origin was murky, but according to the Song of Roland, somehow an angel had got hold of it and given it to Charlemagne. Did it truly have a tooth of St. Peter inside its golden hilt? Arshar touched the hilt again, holding his fingers against the warmth of the metal. A hair from Saint-Denis, a piece of cloth from the Virgin Mary's cloak, and a drop of blood from St. Basil. All those things were said to have gone into its making, and now it was his. But was he worthy of it? And of being Dr. Lawton's Roland? Arshar had memorized the Song of Roland, perhaps the oldest surviving French manuscript of any consequence. He'd been with Dr. Lawton for the past 5 years, coming to the scholar in much the same way Sarah had, through the university. He hadn't been a student at first, but rather a teacher, one relatively fresh from his doctoral degree and entrenched in the religious studies department. Arshar's wife, in the history department, had suggested they attend one of Dr. Lawton's lectures after dinner one night. He'd agreed to go because it would gain him wife points, which usually translated into out-of-the-ordinary sex. The topic, religion's influence on medieval European conflicts, held enough of an interest that Arshar had stayed awake through the entire presentation. He was more fascinated by religion and its permutations in present-day society, but was nonetheless captivated by Lawton's intensity and the way the man could hold a crowd on such an otherwise dry topic. Arshar had recognized the charisma and power in Dr. Lawton, and had started attending more lectures, some with his wife, most without. Drawn like a moth. Had he traded one addiction for another? Arshar smiled at that thought. If so, it had been a more than fair trade. A far better addiction, this. His interest in religion had begun in high school, when his parents sent him to Avignon to seek penance for his obsession with girls. He'd gotten two pregnant before his 16th birthday. Well, three, but one he'd managed to sweep under the carpet on his own. His father was well off, and paid for his indiscretions, after eliciting a promise from him to study with the order in Avignon. Arshar spent the summer among the monks before deciding their lifestyle was a little too austere for his tastes, especially since he couldn't tamp down his interest in women. And so, come the fall, he'd mixed his two fields at the university, delving into religious studies while pursuing as many girls as he could manage, given his academic work. Eventually, he tried to settle down with a beautiful history major who agreed to share a flat with him at the edge of campus. In time, they married. He knew she was aware that he sometimes stepped out on her, but he wondered if she knew just how often. And then Arshar's promiscuity became an issue with Dr. Lawton. The more time he spent with the professor, and the more he opened up about his life, the more Lawton beseeched him to change.
Choose your penchant for flesh, or choose salvation for your soul. There isn't room in my company for both.
Dr. Lawton said no more on the matter for several months. The more lectures Arshar attended, the more he fell under the professor's spell. He even enrolled in some classes as a student himself, and the professor took him under his wing.
You are my Roland.
Lawton had told him that on a weekend trip to the Imperial War Museum and the Tower of London in England. That night over dinner, the professor had outlined his plan, and Arshar bought into it. But Dr. Lawton worried that his Roland could not wholly focus on their mission. Women had always been the one chink in his armor, the one distraction that kept him from a perfect life. So Arshar found a doctor in Paris who cured his sexual appetite with anti-androgen drugs. In some circles, it was called chemical castration, though that was a misnomer, as he remained intact. It was a treatment the courts sometimes imposed on molesters or rapists. The drugs reduced his libido by suppressing his testosterone. Women no longer aroused him. His wife left him and left the university. He'd chosen this chaste, important life over the bawdy, selfish one he'd left behind. A good trade. A more than adequate trade. In the Song of Roland, the paladin had used Durandal to hold 100,000 Muslims at bay until Charlemagne and his army could retreat into France. Arshar turned and regarded the two men and Sarah.
Recovering the sword, embarking on Dr. Lawton's quest, nothing but good will come.
So, who's gonna fix the sword? I mean, it's not really much use with the end of it broken like that, is it?
Let Dr. Lawton know we're ready, Sarah.
The largest oil painting on the wall, lit museum style in an ornate gold frame above the wainscoting, was a portrait of a well-dressed man with an abundance of black curls that fell past his shoulders. His face was all angles and planes, his eyes hooded and intense. There were other paintings, too, and all of them looked as if they'd been rendered by the old masters. The room in which they were displayed was opulent, the furnishings new, but not modern. Brocade cushions on white high-backed chairs, settees, low tables, candelabras, a thick rug on the floor shot through with metallic threads. It all looked to be a carefully arranged tourist exhibit. There was even a velvet rope stretched across one section of wall to keep people from getting too close to the paintings. But this wasn't a public exhibition. It was simply a favorite spot in Dr. Lawton's warehouse in Paris. He nudged back a heavy drape and peered out the window, looking down on the loading dock and at another warehouse across the street. The neighboring structures were busier. One supplied grocers, another automotive dealers. In reality, The automotive supplier was a front for stolen cars coming into Europe from the United States. Dr. Lawton found the operation distasteful and intended to turn them in when he wrapped up his own business in the area. His antiques storage warehouse was a front as well. He cluttered the lower level with all manner of objects he purchased legally. Some of them were even rare finds, although one object that had arrived a short time ago couldn't fit into that category.
Dr. Lawton, we're back.
I know. I saw the car in the van arrive.
It took longer than I thought it would, going to that dink burg of a town and...
And?
It's downstairs. Arshar has it. Do you want to...
Of course.
Should I have him bring...
No, I'll come down.
Lawton stepped away from the window and let the drape fall back. Dr. Lawton was a striking man. Tall, always impeccably groomed, well-dressed in clothes that were both dapper and a little out of fashion. He stood out. He wore his hair long, as he believed a history professor should. His spectacles had a nearly invisible frame, so as not to obscure his face. He stood there studying the girl. Woman, he corrected himself, but just barely. Sarah was young, beautiful, though he had to really look to see it. She unwittingly dimmed her loveliness by wearing baggy shirts spouting slogans and pictures of whatever rock band she was into. This evening, Sarah sported a white skull and crossbones with bat wings and A7X in big block letters. Her makeup did nothing to improve her appearance. She wore thick eyeliner and layered on the mascara. Smudges of shimmering green and blue paste covered her lids and tapered to points. Her lipstick was dark, unnatural, never red.
We got into Paris a few hours ago, but I needed to clean up and change. My clothes got pretty well shredded. It was worse than those rock-climbing walls at the gym. Not the big part of the sword. It was just hanging out there in the open. Right where your research said it would be. But the tip of it, it was exactly like the legend you taught in class. Roland had tried to throw the sword away off the cliff so the enemy wouldn't get it. But the blade hit the stone and a piece of it broke off and stayed there.
And the monks displayed the sword incomplete.
Yeah. They never bothered to go get the other piece. I had a hell of a time in the dark finding the spot where that little shard was in the cliff. Then I had a hell of a time getting it.
God guided your hands and brought the pieces together so that they could be reforged.
Yeah. So who's going to get this one? Arshar? I figured it would be Arshar because of Roland's significance. He thinks it's going to be his sword. He's down there drooling over it. Are you...
Yes, Durandal is to be Arshad's sword.
Am I going to... Are you going to...
If there are enough, Sarah, I do not intend to leave you out.
Lawton faced the large portrait.
He died on the 28th of January. It was the seventh day since he'd taken to his bed, and after his final Holy Communion. Did you know that?
I'm not much of a historical scholar. I tried to be. Loved your courses. Maybe I shouldn't have quit like I did, but...
He was 72 years old, 47 years into his reign. Twice my age when the pleurisy killed him. Buried the same day, in Aachen Cathedral. The rush wasn't necessary. It had been so cold and the disease hadn't touched his outward appearance. A count in Aachen claimed to have found and opened the tomb, finding the corpse inside sitting on a throne, decked out with a crown and scepter. The tight flesh over the bones incorrupt. God-touched. He died depressed. He hadn't been afraid of death coming. That comes to all men. But he was afraid of being incomplete.
What?
There were things left undone.
But you will finish those things.
Together, we will finish those things. If your belief grows stronger, if I can sense in you an honest interest and desire, if you shed your youthful curiosity, if you follow me honestly.
I do. I will.
If you are to be one of my 12, you must convince me, Sarah.
Anything. I'll do anything.
Then prepare for another foray. Now, shall we see Roland's Durandal?
The big staircase was a wrought iron circular one he'd imported from an ironworks in Scotland. It ended in the center of a massive room filled with crates and forklifts, the trappings of a warehouse, an illusion he found satisfactory. Lawton approached Arshar, who was kneeling in front of one of the smaller crates, now draped with a length of velvet. It was as close to an altar as could be arranged here. The lighting was poor, which helped hide the true nature of the building, but the makeshift altar was directly beneath one of the fixtures.
Dr. Lawton.
Durandal, our mission has begun in earnest.
Raymond Hayes was Anya's photographer for the Dog Men segment in Avignon. He'd worked diligently with her on the project for the past 3.5 days, and now he stood by his wheeled suitcase at the concierge counter, having just rolled it across the marble floor of the Hotel Danieli lobby. He'd been her cameraman in the catacombs under Paris before that, never complaining, happy to get the work, in fact, as he was a hungry freelancer. But he'd just gotten a text from his daughter, who was on her way to the hospital to give birth. He was obviously going to miss the event, but he wanted to get back home to New York as soon as possible. And Anya sympathized. His daughter would be a first-time mom with single-parent responsibilities.
I thought it was a wrap that we were done. You sent the rest of the crew home.
I thought it was a wrap too, Ray. I'm very sorry, but...
Plenty of footage, Anya. We have some great color work. I called. We can catch a flight in 2 hours at the Comont Airport, just outside town. It'll take us to Manchester, and we can connect to New York and...
Be home after tomorrow. I thought your daughter wasn't due for another 2 weeks.
The baby had other ideas, I guess.
Look, your wife's with her, right?
Yes.
Then she'll get your daughter through this. We've got one more interview. Some tipster named Gaston claims to be one of the dog men.
That's what Doug Morrell's call was about? One more interview? We don't need it.
I might not have liked this whole assignment, Ray, but I'm not going to do a half-assed job when this could add something to an otherwise mediocre piece. And that's what our dogmen story is right now. Nothing special.
Damn, Anya.
I'm not going to argue with Doug about it. We're doing this.
Doug doesn't have a pregnant single daughter.
Doug's 22.
My point. All your beloved producer cares about are ratings.
Let's go see this guy and get it over with. Then we'll take the train back to Paris and get a direct flight. We might still make it home sometime tomorrow.
Damn, Anya.
After asking the bellman to store their bags, Anya stepped out of the hotel with Raymond.
A dog man, eh?
A cynocephalus.
Yeah, I know what he's called. I just hope he's had his rabies shot.
We'll walk. It's not far from the hotel. The Centre Historique.
Our old hotel was closer.
You're gonna complain about everything today, aren't you, Ray?
Yes.
Their previous lodgings, the Avignon Grand Hotel, had been much closer, practically across the street from their meet at the Palais des Papes. But their stay there hadn't sat well with Anya, after the beating she'd taken in the stairwell and the theft of her laptop from her room. She'd told Raymond about the theft, but didn't mention the beating. After she'd come to at the bottom of the stairs, picked herself up and staggered back to her room, she'd discovered that all her things were just where she'd left them. But there were tiny differences that raised the hairs on the back of her neck, and there was the missing computer. So she'd relocated the crew to the Danieli and reported the theft to the police. Again, she didn't report the beating. Anya healed quickly, a strange phenomenon somehow linked to the sword, and she didn't want to explain that particular quirk to her photographer or the police. They were soaked by the time they reached the cluster of centuries-old buildings at the edge of the Rhone. It looked as if the walls of the medieval structures might tumble down the bank and spill into the river. The grandest, the Palais des Papes, was considered one of the most important Gothic buildings in Europe. Anya had been through it twice in the past. They shook themselves off just inside the entrance.
The Palace of Popes, huh? And the place of dogmen? I sure do hope our subject is kept nice and dry in here.
Hmm?
You've never had a dog, have you?
No dogs.
Well, they stink to high heaven when they get wet.
I like you better when you smile.
That doesn't mean I think this interview is a good idea.
Raymond brushed the water drops off his camera, then dug a dry handkerchief out of his pocket to wipe it.
So what's with this place? Enlighten me a little. Only got an outside shot of it 2 days ago for color on the city.
Gaston Bertrand de Gaulle, Pope Clement V, moved the papacy here after his election in 1305. This building went up after his death. Terribly expensive.
You'd think religious people would spend the money on the poor. It'd be the religious thing to do.
This was fortified to withstand attacks, expanded over the years. The wings flanked with high towers. Adjoining buildings were added to enclose the courtyard.
Beautiful, but excessive.
Despite the archaeological significance of the place, Anya agreed with him. A dozen tourists wandered in the cloister, and they looked so tiny under the high, arched ceiling, like ants. No doubt the rain was keeping the bulk of the tourists away. Anya tried to imagine what the place had looked like when the popes walked these chambers, before it had been seized and sacked, before it became the setting for a massacre of revolutionaries in the late 1700s and was turned into a barracks and prison. Frescoes had been obliterated, the interior woodwork used to build stables. But in the early 1900s, when it became a museum, restoration began, and the renovation work still continued all these years later. The place carried the smell of old stone and cleaning products, and through the open front door came the smell of the wet city and the Rhone. Raymond focused his camera on the tourists.
So what's our dog man look like? A Great Dane? Boxer? A Bitzer?
Bitzer?
A Bitzer. Bitzer this and Bitzer that. A mutt.
No idea. Doug's note said Gaston would find us. We just have to be visible and wait for him.
Wait. That's great.
Raymond edged farther in, dribbling water on the stone. Anya followed him, looking down corridors that led to other wings.
Yeah, so how long do we wait? I say we give him an hour, tops. That'd maybe still give us time to catch that plane and...
Mrs. Creed.
Anya and Raymond whirled around to face a wiry youth standing just past the entrance, squinting against the rain. His oversized pants and jacket made him look small. Anya stepped closer. Raymond began filming.
Miss Creed, are you Gaston?
Gaston? No, not me. My brother's name is Gaston. I am to bring you to him.
Oh, great. This isn't the guy, it's his brother. We don't have time for a scavenger hunt. Gaston was supposed to meet us here. That was the message, right, Anya? That was the deal.
He doesn't like to be seen in public, Miss Creed. He's only doing this because of the money. You promised money for the interview.
We're paying for an interview, Anya?
According to Doug, we're paying this guy.
This just gets better and better.
Is he close, your brother? Nearby?
Under the bridge, away from the rain and people. He hides there, and you will pay him to talk to you, right? He said he would only talk for money.
He talks, and then I make arrangements to pay him. I didn't bring the money with me. I'm not carrying cash. The money is at the hotel. He talks to me, you come back with me to the hotel and get it. I promise to pay.
That is all right, I guess. You come now, and then you give me money.
What's your name?
Jacques.
It'll be a Bitzer, for sure.